Well, I'd like to call the meeting of the Administrative Simplification Advisory Committee to order. Thank you all for coming. I want to let you know that we have Representative Breida Saylor on the conference call, and so we're going to do our best to encourage her to participate as well. So we'll maybe checking in with you periodically, Breida, just to make sure that your comments and concerns are a part of it as well. Haven't chaired a meeting where one person's by conference call, so we'll make that work. But I think we should first go around with introductions again so that everyone knows who they are, who's on the line, as well as who's here. And would you mind beginning, John?
My name is John Berg. I'm a commissioner from Watlin County.
John Everett, commissioner in Clay County.
Commissioner Nancy Schuyler, Dakota County.
Linda Berglund, state senator, and I believe we'll be joined a little later by Senator Kathy Sharon as well.
And I'm Representative Diane Loeffler.
I'm Chuck Johnson, assistant commissioner with the Department of Human Services.
Lynn Singelman, chief of staff at the Department of Human Services.
Kelly Harder, human services director, Steele County.
Kathy Johnson, social services director, Kitson County.
Well, great. The first item we have on our agenda is an update on the Health Match Program and the Healthcare Connect with Troy Mangan making a presentation. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Troy Mangan, and I'm from the Minnesota Department of Human Services. First order of business here is an update on Health Match. As most of you know, back in March of this year, the department terminated its contract with the vendor that we had brought on to help us develop Health Match. At that point, we initiated a 30-day assessment period, and at the end of that time, we decided to initiate a six-month project recovery period. Through that six-month period, which is coming to close soon here, we've worked on three main deliverables around this project. The first was around project management. Included in that was some changes in project governance to kind of clarify the roles within the department. We also included some staffing reduction as part of that, moved some folks off of the project to more focus on the software development piece of the project. And we've hired an executive director, a person with some significant project recovery experience from the private sector to help us work through the project recovery and into the next phase of the project.
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
Who is that person?
His name is Mark Buchstaber, Buchstaber. And he's had experience at United Health, among other places. The second phase of the project, and again, we've implemented, significantly restructured the project governance and worked on a communication plan and other things around the recovery. The second deliverable was focusing on the business requirements for the project. We've hired four new business analysts to help lead that effort, been reviewing the business requirements documents from the existing project. We are really focusing on developing those requirements and retooling those requirements to be RFP ready. If at some point in the future the department needs to move forward on a request for proposal for someone else to come in to work on the project, we want the requirements to be ready for that. It's not to say that we've made that decision, but we want to be prepared for that if need be. The final deliverable is around technical assessment. This includes some things like researching other rules engines. As you know, Health Match was based on a rules engine concept that would take a person's information, personal information, asset information, those sorts of things, and work towards developing an eligibility conclusion for that person. So we've done some research on other rules engines. We've issued an RFI for some existing technical solutions, so looking at are there solutions out there that are available that we might be able to adapt to the to this project. Things have changed considerably since we initiated this project years ago, so it's a chance for us to look and see what other solutions are out there. We have identified some preliminary project continuation options, and probably the main deliverable for this will be a recommendation to DHS senior management within the next month about a project continuation option. Which direction should we go in terms of doing an RFP, doing it ourselves? There's a variety of options in terms of moving forward, and the Health Match team will be making those recommendations to senior management, and senior management will go through their process to make a decision about project direction. But we should know that by the end of November. There's no promises on that date, but that's the timeline right now.
Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair and Mr. Mangan, how many people were working on Health Match in the department before the contract was terminated?
I'm sorry, I don't have that information off the top of my head. I don't. I can certainly get that to you, and then the numbers that are working on that now. But I don't have that right now.
So you don't know how many people in the department are working on it now?
No, I don't. Health Match is not my primary responsibility. It's Minnesota Healthcare Connect. So I was asked to kind of pinch hit today. But we can certainly get that information. It's readily available. But I don't have that off the top of my head. I apologize.
Great. Thank you.
And I had a concern about whether, as we're kind of regrouping at this point, we ought to go back and think about whether we should be simplifying the system before we once again build a system to deal with all of its complexities. And I think that's always been a challenge of Health Match, and it was initiated before I was elected to office. But it sort of builds in and solidifies some of the complexities that we have right now, which this committee is charged to try and identify and streamline. And it seems like I would hope that in the next month, as you're evaluating options, that the department would seriously look at whether or not we ought to have a major simplification initiative before we actually go back into, you know, serious programming of the current system. Because it's always expensive, as we've learned through fiscal notes, to make any changes once you've got the computer programming done. And it seems like to me that there's a lot of momentum about trying to streamline many processes in our eligibility system. The counties have provided us lists of manual overrides that they have to deal with and issues related to the current system. And if we could address those as an update of what our needs are, I think that would be useful information in the decision-making.
That's a very good point.
Any other questions on this topic? Yes, Mr. Harder.
Madam Chair, Troy, thank you for coming and sharing. Are you aware of my understanding then within a month there will be a proposal made within DHS to its management team? Once, let's say that within the department some plan of action is agreed upon, is there any thought about, if you would, a comment period? I get a little concerned about, you know, I understand from a technical standpoint, it sounds like you've hired some real strong horsepower to help independently analyze what should be done going forward. And at the same time, on the back end of it, you have the machine that runs it is at the county level, and we've had some thoughts and ideas as well about how if you're going to do a priority, maybe healthcare. Eventually, we know it needs to be done, but could you do food support? Or could we get something out there where you could see a tangible product at the end of it? And so do you have any sense of what the timeline would look like if and when the department finalizes a decision on where it's going with this?
I don't, but it's certainly a recommendation that we could give to senior management team or?
Madam Chair, I can comment on that, I think,
Mr.
Kelly.
Johnson.
We have revived the steering committee for Health Match. I think that's the name of it. But there was a committee that included county people that we met with regularly, and we're trying to revive that to be part of the process. And I don't think we've worked out exactly what's going to happen, but certainly we're willing to commit to engaging with the counties and other stakeholders as we get to the process of finalizing the decision.
Thanks.
Great. If there's no other questions on that, I think we'll move forward to the topic that Mr. Mangan is actually much more familiar with, and that is Minnesota Healthcare Connect, which we heard at our last meeting is a model of, from the perspective of many of the people around the table, of ways that the partnership between DHS and the counties might evolve. So we're interested in both the process as well as the product, as you're describing that to us. Thank
you. All right. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the praise about our collaboration with the counties. What I'd like to do today, and there's a PowerPoint handout in your packet that I'll be going through, is give you a overview of a recently completed evaluation that we did of the healthcare eligibility and enrollment system, as well as talk about some of the next steps we have moving forward. Healthcare Connect has been around in one form or another for 5 or 6 years. It started out as healthcare BPR, business process redesign. There was an original healthcare BPR committee that included both MAXA members and DHS staff. In 2005, we got a legislative authority to go forward with an eligibility pilot. In 2006, we reformed the steering committee, including the membership on the second slide on that first page, but focused at that point on an evaluation steering committee, again, including members from nominated by MAXA from a variety of counties. The focus of that group was developing and issuing an RFP, which we put out, and in February of last year, February 2007, we brought on board a vendor, PSI Incorporated, to do an evaluation, and they concluded their work in May 2008, and I'll talk in more detail about that evaluation. One of the first steps in the evaluation was developing a vision statement for us stepping back and being clear about what is it that we really want from this evaluation and from this project, and that vision statement on the bottom slide, I think, captures it really well. Looking at a model process for Minnesota healthcare program eligibility and enrollment, with a couple of key factors there. One is the partnership between the states and the counties, the state and the county. The counties obviously do the bulk of the eligibility and enrollment work, although the state also through Minnesota Care does a lot of work for enrolling folks into health plans or into healthcare. Looking at a focus on experience of the customer, we can change the processes all we want to make it work really well for our workers, but if it doesn't in the end result in the clients receiving better services, we've missed something. Basing on the expertise of our employees, we have a very complex system with 120 some eligibility types. We need to really rely on the expertise of our employees to help us both get through any kind of redesign or change, but also as we move into the future, we need to have those folks involved in the system because it's not something that a person can learn overnight. A focus on service efficiency integrity, and then I think the last thing is really important, driving our changes based on data, and that the evaluation gave us data that we haven't had before about the system. Moving to the next page, next step in the project was defining some benefit and performance metrics. We ended up going from about 100 metrics down to 23 across four different benefit domains. These are pretty key domains for not just healthcare eligibility, but I think a lot of human services, trying to be cost-effective, trying to improve customer service, try to increase our administrative flexibility so that we can better deal with the changes that come down the road, both from the state legislature and from the federal government, and improving our program integrity. That's become a huge concern, most recently from from CMS. Examples of this, for example, improving customer service metric would be the processing time to initial application. We want to get people to that initial decision as fast as possible. If you have to end up waiting 2 months to hear about your health, whether you're eligible for health care, that's not great customer service. If we can get that done in half the time, we're doing well. After we developed those metrics and we defined targets for each one of those, and those were sort of the goals for this project, is let's get to a reasonable target for each one of these 23 metrics, see how we're doing now, and then the goal of our improvement initiatives going forward is to get us closer to that those targets. We use those targets in the next step of the project, which is developing an as-is report. Our vendor went out to six different counties, including Kitson County and Steele County, as well as Minnesota Care, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Lincoln Lyon Murray Region 8 North, to actually sit down with supervisors and staff in each of those counties and sort of look over their shoulders as they did their work. We also surveyed over 800 financial workers and supervisors, and ended up getting information back from about 20 different county directors in terms of things like position descriptions, performance requirements, those sorts of things. We also collected data from DHS. The end conclusion of that, when our vendor took all of that data and modeled the system, was that right now we have as of June 2007, we had about 1,990 FTEs in the system devoted to healthcare. So if I'm a worker and doing cash, food support, and healthcare, it was just a portion of my time devoted to healthcare that was included in this. In order to hit the metrics that we established earlier on in the project, our vendor estimated that we would need 2,850 FTEs to be able to do the work in the system. That's without any process changes, just essentially throwing how many bodies would we need to throw at the problem to be able to hit those metrics that we established earlier on. So a pretty considerable gap between the number of workers that we actually have and the number of workers required to meet the metrics. And again, those metrics were pretty reasonable targets. They weren't pie in the sky things. They were what do we reasonably think the system should be able to accomplish.
Chair. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Mr. Mangan, does this number of workers take into account the fact that we changed the eligibility renewal period for Minnesota Care from 6 months to a year during this past session?
This was as of the workload as of 2007, so it would have not taken into account any changes made in 2008.
So do we have any idea what impact that would have on this number?
I don't off the top of my head. I don't. It would require a different, remodeling the system or changing some of the assumptions, and that's, we don't have the vendor on board anymore, so it's not something that we could.
Well, I guess maybe I could ask the question in a different way. Since much of the Minnesota Care eligibility is done within the department, is the department planning on reducing any of their FTEs, or was the workload such that they will manage to maintain the same number of FTEs?
I do not believe that there were any reductions in the Minnesota Care staff as a result of that, but I can't be sure of that, so I would not...
Maybe somebody could get back to us. I just point that out because I think it's a big difference between what we have in front of us here, and we shouldn't think that what we have in front of us here is current.
Yes, certainly it is a point in time. It is June 2007 based on the caseloads at that time, the existing rules and procedures that were in place at that time. The conclusion from that as-is report was that, that are both county and state resources, and again, those 1,990 include both Minnesota Care and county staff, that the resources are overextended, which results in a couple things. Cases don't get processed in a timely manner. People get backed up. Workers inconsistently follow rules and procedures, and part of that is because of the caseload, our supervisors and our trainers end up taking on workloads themselves to try to alleviate this backlog and don't have as much time to do the supervision and training that's necessary to help people comply with rules. And significant employee turnover. We especially see that in the metro area that, not surprisingly, a very stressful job makes it harder to retain people. Our conclusion also was that additional resources are necessary. They're going to have to come from multiple sources. But we also need infrastructure and process changes. Again, it's not just a matter of throwing bodies at the problem. We need to look at how is it that we can work more efficiently and work better within the system to be able to meet some of this, relieve some of this overwork. The next step in the evaluation, turning the page, was to look at health match. We sort of were building on an as-is, sort of system as it is. At that time and still today, we believe that some sort of automated rules engine is going to be a critical part of any kind of changes in the healthcare eligibility system. So we looked at modeling Health Match as it existed in June 2007. So, again, that was quite a while ago in terms of where Health Match is, obviously, given my previous update. But it gives you a sense about what we thought Health Match would be like, would do to the system at that time. Looking at the modeling based on the assumptions that were built into the Health Match development at that time, we looked at significant program integrity improvements, and clearly that's what Health Match was designed to do, is to get people into the right eligibility category. So if we hadn't had these, it would be a surprise. So we saw a 71% reduction in MEQC errors as a result of Health Match, a significant reduction of that 860-person gap by introducing automation, and reduction in the application pen times and standard deviations down to about what people thought was a minimum level. After Health Match, then we ended up as a steering committee brainstorming some further initiatives in terms of what other things could we do to improve the system. We went from about 20 down to 4 initiatives: statewide electronic document management system, especially support of long-term care cases, enrollment broker, and client choice of venue. For each of these, we had folks who were really experts in those areas help us model those initiatives and come up with the assumptions around how would those impact the existing system. Statewide electronic document management system, this is an imaging system. We'd want this on a statewide basis. Some counties do this right now. The majority of counties do not. But this is putting all the documentation related to someone's healthcare eligibility into an electronic image, being able to transfer cases within counties, across counties, between counties and Minnesota Care electronically. We want to have multiple options for counties to work with those that actually have EDMS systems now, so they don't have to look at something new. Need to establish some standard protocols. That's the only way you can work, is if you're all talking in the same language between the different counties. And we want to use it for all financial programs, not just for healthcare, because many of the verifications and other documentation required for healthcare are the same as for cash and food support, and there's no sense in us collecting those in multiple ways. That's one of the beauties of having EDMS, is it can be all in one format. Specialized support of long-term care cases, we know that...
Interrupt again.
Yes, Senator Berglund.
Of the cases that are applying for health care, how many are there that are also applying for financial support or food support?
I don't have the exact figure on that. I know that the number of health care-only cases has been growing recently, but I don't have the exact data on the amount of ones that are across multiple programs.
Well, I just bring that up because I think that's an important point, you know, that if we're going to get, you know, bogged down in trying to create a system that does everything for every program, you know, how many people actually are applying for every program makes a difference to me in terms of whether I think it might be worth it or not.
I might just say, in my understanding of the scope of the business improvement effort that you were leading, was that it was also not to really look at changing the system we have. It was more about how do you process things within the existing system. Is that correct? So it wouldn't have addressed some of the issues that have been brought up in previous meetings about, you know, one computer system doesn't talk to another, and, you know, some of those technology engineering. Is that correct?
Well, I think that the major thing that is excluded from our scope is policy changes. I mean, those are something that, as you had mentioned earlier, that we need to look at, but we're not including that in the scope. In terms of technology issues, I mean, we get into some of that, for example, with EDMS systems and counties having different EDMS systems and being able to talk between those systems and between the state. So you get into some of those. When we start talking about some of the major systems and those, how those work together, that is not something that we've included in our scope. So there's a technology aspect to it, but not in terms of the major systems.
One of the things I'm hoping that we can have in a future meeting is actually a demonstration of someone processing an application and a renewal and seeing what the state of the computer systems are. Because until I saw this a year ago, I just never could believe that we still have green screens with black letters that look like, you know, 1970 computers. And none of it's in English. You have to teach people a bazillion codes. I heard you say there's 120 eligibility categories, but that's just at the top level. And so that's part of the problem with recruiting and retaining employees, let alone the response time. If I had to sit at a computer all day with that kind of response time, I'd run out of the room on the first day. But, you know, we have people who are dedicated and do a good job and do follow through on it, but I do think we need to look at that in order to understand the context of some of the environment in which all of these things would happen. So that might be useful, and we might be able to do it with a county that already has an electronic data system, so you could actually see what that impact might be of this first recommendation. Thank you. Let's continue.
The second initiative we looked at is specialized support of long-term care cases. We know long-term care eligibility is very complex to us and becoming more so, and we're also just obviously with demographics seeing many more people falling into applying for long-term care cases, for long-term care eligibility. There's two pieces to this that we looked at as part of the initiative. One is a certification program for long-term care workers to make sure that there's the same level of knowledge across those workers. The second is developing some sort of centralized or regional group for difficult cases, those folks that have more complex assets, community spouses, long look-back periods. We actually estimated about two-thirds of the long-term care cases we could be classified as difficult, which gives you a sense about what it's like to do that kind of eligibility work. But this was to offer a resource for those counties that may not choose to have a certified worker or may not have enough volume to really be to do a good job with those cases, and many smaller counties don't see enough to really have the expertise to deal with these complex cases when they come through the door. So we imagine that this centralized group would do some consultation, would actually process some of those cases, and at least have the capability in some cases to hold those cases. The person would still be in that county of financial responsibility, but the case would be held more centrally or regionally to help deal with the changes, because oftentimes once people get eligible, there's also there's constant changes in the financial instruments that they have devoted to their long-term care. So to help deal with those changes going forward. The third initiative is an enrollment broker, and this would be someone to do centralized enrollment into health plans.
Senator Berglund?
If I can just interrupt again to ask a question. Were these 20%, 60%, 20% numbers estimates, or was there some definition that you had that would you would know which type of case would fall into which category?
Senator Berglund, committee members, those were just estimates from that were modeled by the vendor going forward. One of the things that we will need to do is to define what is a difficult case, what would be the circumstances under which this central group would take it on a consulting basis, would take it over. Those are things that we need to move forward. These were just assumptions that the vendor made as part of their modeling and that we signed off on as a steering committee.
Thank you.
Yep, Representative Breeder.
I am having difficulty understanding what Mr. Magnin's testimony. Is there any way that someone could email to me the handout that you would give us to at least follow along, if that possible?
We will try and make that happen. Do you have it electronically in a way that could make that happen easily?
I'm sorry, I do not.
Or can we have someone scan it and send it? We're going to try that, Representative Saylor. I must say that just for your information, Mr. Magnin has pretty much been saying in his commentary what we're seeing on the handout.
Yes, and I apologize if I've not been clear. So I'll try to do better as we finish up here.
Is there a time frame for the work group on long-term care cases to come out with a model or a proposal?
I'll, in a few slides from now, I'll get into the actual where we're at in terms of the implementation. So,
okay, thank you.
I'll keep you in suspense. So enrollment broker, centralizing enrollment into health plans. Right now, counties do a lot of this enrollment. It involves mailing out of packets. County perspective, or many counties' perspective, it's costly and takes up a lot of time, and is maybe not necessarily the best way to provide information to folks about health plans. I know there's been some discussions as part of this committee about health plan enrollment and how to simplify the job for counties. This is looking at centralizing that and taking the responsibility for open enrollment and initial enrollment into health plans away from the counties and being able to provide that centrally. And hopefully freeing up worker time to do things that are more focused on direct client interaction. The last initiative is client choice of venue. This is just for those folks that have healthcare only. The idea here is that I can, as a consumer, be able to access the system wherever I choose to. If I want to do it mostly electronically through an online application, through a website as a portal for information. I can do that. If I want to do it through the counties and get either my Minnesota Care or my MA through the county, I can do that. If I want to go through the state Minnesota Care operations to get my health care, I can do that. This requires a lot of different things in place. Certainly something like Health Match needs to be there for folks to be able to process all cases rather than just sort of the cases that they're doing right now. That, you know, we need something of a centralized contact center to help direct folks to the resources that they need, a sort of 1-800 healthcare number. We need some sort of centralized processing center, at least at the state end, to be able to deal with the applications that would come in. We see that this gives us a way to deal with some of the unsolicited client contacts, which from our modeling was a big, and from the county's experience, is a big takes up a lot of time from the county's end, is dealing with those clients calling in saying, is my application completed yet? Those sorts of calls, which we want to be responsive to folks, but also take time away from the work of actually getting those applications processed. So you need something like an IVR where you can call in and check the status of your application. This is a sort of the roll-up of many different things in the initiative. You need EDMS, you need a health match-like product. There's a lot of changes that we need to go forward with the client choice of venue, but that's sort of where we're moving. We'd like to move towards as an ultimate goal.
Mr. Mangan, I'm assuming one of the issues that you're going to wrestle with that then is how do you staff up, because you're not going to know where the, at least for a while, where the demand's going to be. And
yes, that's clearly a big part. The modeling in this included that 50% of the healthcare only cases would go through the state operation, but clearly you would have some time in terms of the beginning of this, seeing how that kind of shook out in terms of where people make their choices. So yeah, that's a very one big unknown in this. The recommendations from the evaluation process was that all four of those initiatives plus Health Match should go forward and be implemented. The largest gains came from all four of those and Health Match together, but there were significant gains in efficiency if we just did the four initiatives without Health Match as well. We wanted to model that given the where we were at with Health Match. All four of those initiatives plus Health Match yield the optimal structure, which really significantly cuts down that gap between the work and available staff, reduces new application pen time significantly, and reduces the number of FTEs per transaction. The interesting part about this is from the evaluation was that the net cost for implementing that optimal structure, and this doesn't include the Health Match development costs, but it's the ongoing cost of bringing up those initiatives and then running them, was about $63 million over 5 years. The cost of just staffing up 860 FTEs is about the same in just 1 year. So from a cost perspective, it makes a lot more sense, much less the, you know, myriad of issues around actually trying to bring 860 workers into the system. Moving to the next page, I'll just talk very briefly here since I know I'm way over my time and I apologize, for where we're going in terms of next step. We have an EDMS subcommittee that includes county MAXA reps as well as DHS folks, and work groups under that include both the county and DHS. We've got some things going forward around a statewide taxonomy, developing requirements. We're continuing to work with the Human Services Technology Committee and starting to talk with OET about their role in a statewide EDMS system. In terms of specialized support of long-term care, we've met internally within DHS. We've had MAXA designate some subcommittee representatives, and we're going to be meeting with them in the next month. And that will include both, again, DHS and county staff. In terms of enrollment broker, we're still working internally within DHS and trying to draft the scope and the requirements around that. We want to working with our folks in Minnesota Care and in our managed care unit. So we're going to start to draft a requirements document that describes this is what we think the enrollment broker should do. And then at some point, I hope by the end of the year, go to MAXA to ask for participation on that subcommittee to start to get the county input into that enrollment function. And in client choice of venue, we're not quite as far along. We're working with Hennepin County on an online application project. We just have started, in this case, working with means we've met with them once. We're drafting a scope document, and we're also exploring some electronic verification options within Minnesota Care. We see that as a kind of critical piece of this, is being able to do your verifications electronically rather than sort of have to wait for businesses or individuals to respond. I listed out some potential client impacts and county and Minnesota Care impacts. We hope that this is better, that this initiative, if we go forward with these pieces, is more responsive to clients, gives them more ways to access information, and we hope from a county and Minnesota Care perspective that it increases our efficiency, that we have better staff retention and better program integrity. We know that the last bullet on there, this is a critical piece, that there will be some changing roles if you think about these initiatives going forward. It does change the roles between counties and between the state and the county, which is why it's been essential for us to have MACSA participation on all of this going forward.
Thank you very much. I did note on your four initiative, there was joint planning on all of them except on the enrollment broker, where it sounded like the work was all being done within DHS. You're going to develop the requirements and then ask for some feedback. And since counties are currently fulfilling this responsibility now, I was kind of surprised that that's one that you didn't have that same
our
joint
plan
development process.
On all these, when we draft things, is in the scope documents or requirements documents, is to basically throw that completely open when we move into the subcommittee level. What we realize with the enrollment piece is that there's systems pieces, there's a lot, it's a lot more complex than we had thought, and we want to try to get that clarified a little bit before, so that we actually look like we know what we're doing when we throw it open to the county. So, but none of this precludes any changes to that. For example, with EDMS, we did the same thing, drafted a scope document and then brought it forward to that committee, and it changed considerably from there. But we want to give people a starting point in terms of saying, here's what we think is needed, and then folks can tear that apart as much as they want to. We've just found it's worked a lot better when we give people a starting point rather than saying, well, let's sit down and talk about what we should do around enrollment. It seems to, I feel like it wastes people's time when we do that, because there's a lot of churning. So, but the folks who are on that enrollment subcommittee can kind of make that determination when we get to that. And if we need to step back and start with something different, we can certainly do that.
Senator Berglund.
So it wasn't really clear to me what the timeline is. It was clear to me that at least for the long-term care portion of it, that by the end of the year you'll be recruiting county representatives to serve on that committee. But the rest of the timeline for all of this wasn't very clear to me.
Well, I apologize for that. The EDMS subcommittee is up and meeting and has been for several months. We've got a statewide taxonomy that we're now testing with our DHS forms, and we have counties testing that with their own forms to see how does this taxonomy work with your own forms. To have an EDMS system, you all have to be talking the same language, and the taxonomy is the language that you're talking about. This kind of form is a form related to asset. This is a form related to income. For those systems to be able to communicate without a lot of human intervention, you have to be able to categorize your forms. So we've worked on that taxonomy. The business and technical requirements is an ongoing effort, and we hope to have that finished by sometime early next year. Certainly moving forward on the EDMS beyond that is something that requires funding, and that's some things that we need to continue to move forward with as a department. But there's considerable funding needed to do an EDMS initiative in terms of bringing up the system, converting all the files that people have right now, the back file conversion. That's an extremely expensive proposition to be able to get the existing files all into an EDMS system and then start to move forward from that. So this is very much dependent on funding going forward. Long-term care cases, again, we have MACSID representatives, and we're going to be moving forward on that. There's more work here that we think that we can do without necessarily having a lot of funding, because we're working on improving the existing policy manual, looking at possibly a procedures manual. So there's some things that we can do internally, and we're going to keep moving forward on those. We're hoping to have the policy manual out within the next several months. This group will work on the certification standards. That will be a piece that we hope will roll out sometime next year. And I have actually more specifics on this. My boss is very clear about that, so I can certainly provide more detailed timelines on each one of these if you need to. Enrollment broker, again, we're hoping by the end of this year to be meeting with the folks on MACS on that. And client choice of venue is sort of further down the road. And, again, there's want to make sure that we're doing a good job with the initiatives that we have. But I do have some more specific timelines and milestones that I can, if this group is interested. We actually have more detailed status reports for each of the initiatives that have some of that, milestones for this fiscal year, next fiscal year, and the timelines associated with those.
I'd appreciate it if you could get that,
yes,
those timelines to us.
I can certainly do that.
Mr. Harder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think one thing that's important is to remember how this Minnesota Healthcare Connect even started, and I'll give you the Reader's Digest version. We as counties, a handful of us directors, started asking the question when Health Connect was out, Health Match, the concept of Health Match. If you take it, the counties and the state are processing health care applications between Minnesota Care and MA and all the other programs. The idea of Health Match is it brings it in through technology, and you gain this inherent efficiency through technology. But then, on the back end of it, the fundamental question was, do we rebifurcate the system? So if a person becomes eligible by the technology, says you're eligible for X service, well, now you better know what county you're in, because some counties process Minnesota Care. All the counties do the Medicaid and those programs. Some counties do Minnesota Care, some counties don't. And so the questions we were asking is, so do we know what are we going to do as a state and counties after the technology is implemented? And don't we run the risk of basically compromising the efficiency we gained through the technology if we send people off into other directions again? And so at its origin, we sat down with Assistant Commissioner Osberg and others, and to their credit, and I think that partnership has been such a true partnership all the way along, is we were in the room and they came up with the concept of doing something like this that led to this, and it has come out with what we very much support at MAXIS, four really good recommendations that when and if implemented, there is some potential efficiency to be had. You have to realize it takes over a year to train a financial worker, just because it is so complicated. And it's a different language. It is literally like going on Loretta or Stone, I suppose, and online learning a different language every day, because that's what the technology requires you. So when they say staff turnover, it's not just about salaries and getting people in. Once you get them in, it takes a year to train, and then you hope they stick around. And that affects everyone, including the state. So that's one thing that I remain somewhat concerned about, is we've never answered that question. So as we move forward with Health Match, which we should, we still, I think, as a system, need to struggle with, so what do we do with it after someone's determined they're eligible? We still have a piece of the system that isn't quite as efficiently aligned as I see, personally. And that wasn't asked, and that's part of, Representative Loeffler, to your question earlier, is part of the assessment was told it was not to get into some of the policy decisions, of which that would be, understandably so. But once again, this was a great project and an initiative that truly counties have been along all along the way, and DHS has been working well on that as also. But that fundamental question is yet to be answered, in my opinion.
Senator Bergman.
Madam Chair, I guess I agree with Representative Loeffler that we need to be moving towards simplification, and I guess it's a matter of how we do it. You know, we could look at each and every program and then try to figure out how to get them more closely like each other, or, you know, we can look at some things that maybe just make common sense. Like, for example, I have never understood why we ask for so much information from people who are very poor. You know, like we think they're going to have all these cars and boats and cabins and things like that. I mean, you know, if you're an elderly person and you're on medical assistance, not on spend down, but just on medical assistance, I mean, really and truly, why do we have to go through all this verification of everything so often? Maybe it makes sense to do a sample verification, but, you know, most of these people do not have changes of circumstances. You know, if anything, maybe their rent went up $10 that year. But if their rent qualified them before, their rent's still going to qualify them if it's $10 more the next year. And I've never understood, you know, I understand, you know, President Bush's initiative. I mean, it was a maybe not well thought out in terms of the time frame that states were given to comply, but the idea that we get all children under 200% of poverty enrolled in a health care program was a good idea, but how many people who are at or below 200% of poverty have much assets? You know, so I know people get all, you know, kind of in bunches about program integrity. But, you know, really and truly, that stuff does need to be balanced against the practicality of implementing something and the goal of getting, you know, in this case, all children covered. And so I agree that we need to move toward some simplification, and I just think we need to try to keep that effort in tune with whatever the goal is, and be really grounded in some reality. You know, how much are we going to invest? How many thousand workers are we going to invest to maybe catch one person that might have, you know, $200 more of something than they otherwise would have been eligible for, really?
Madam Chair?
Representative Saylor.
Probably are eligible, but they are so frustrated with the level of information that they have to give that they just simply throw up their hands and refuse to do it. And these are people that really should be in some sort of help. But I think that level of detail that's being required really not only ties up a lot of time on county staff, but it drives people away. And I sometimes wonder if that was what was to work that way. And, you know, I also think that while we really do need accountability, that's always a very big issue, especially in tight financial times. Putting so much emphasis on the bean counting prevents us from even finding the beans that need to be counted. So I believe that steps that can be taken to simplification are certainly extremely important.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you so much for your report and your work. And I think we'll move on to our next agenda item, which is the legislative auditor report, which we spent our first meeting discussing, had noted that there are a number of examples in process right now or that have been implemented of multi-county collaboration to deal with some of the scarcity issues. And we're lucky enough to have some of the people who know most about that here today. And I don't know if you're going to present individually or as a panel. Kathy, since you're on both the work group and on our list of presenters and listed as the first presenter, why don't you clue us in as to how you'd like to handle this?
Well, I think we'll probably present individually, if that would be okay.
That's fine.
Okay. And I'm sorry to Representative Saylor that, again, I don't have this electronically, so she's going to be at a disadvantage, too. You've got it? Okay. Okay, great. First off, there's a couple disqualifiers I want to make. Number one is that we do have the technology ability in Kitson County to prepare this via computer. However, my person that was under 35 who understood all the computer programs was gone. So this is I literally had to cut and paste some things. But what I did is present some information. I wanted to present two different collaborations in our area of the world, one because it's a state initiative and one that was county initiative driven. And on the front, you see Minnesota regions. I listed the counties that are in Minnesota Region 1. I did star Manoman County because actually they're in Minnesota Region 2. but they, for some reasons, it makes sense for them to work with Region 1, given where they're located, and then they like to swing over to Region 2 for other things that make sense for them. So I just wanted to kind of highlight that for this county, it makes sense to go back and forth between the two regions. On the next page,
excuse me, for the benefit of Representative Saylor, I'll just lead off that this is actually a long list of counties, so that you can put it in context. It's Kitson, Manoman, Marshall, Norman, Pennington, Polk, Red Lake, and Roseau.
Correct. Thank you. On the next page, I just wanted to give you a visual. Is if when you think of Region 1, think of the state of Vermont, in that we're quite similar in many ways. Now, this is my literal cut and paste, so I don't want to say that this is to scale, but it kind of gives you an idea of the state of Vermont at its widest point on its northern border is 80 miles wide and 160 miles long. Region 1 is about approximately 100 miles wide and 140 miles long. They have 9,250 square miles. We have about 8,494 square miles. They have 66 people per square mile. We have 9 people per square mile in our region. So I just wanted to kind of give you a visual of what we're talking about when we talk about Region 1. In Kitson County and Marshall County, the county right south of us, we both, Kitson County has a little over, I think, 4.2 people per square mile. Both Kitson and Marshall would qualify as frontier counties on the federal calculations. And that's something that, as I talk with the state, is especially when they're working on waivers with the feds to make allowances for those parts of the state that might need a little extra consideration given our population. Our adult mental health initiative started through the state, with the funding from the state, and for us to come together and collaborate as a table as a region. Again, it's the 8 counties that were listed, including then our members that are at the table are our 2 mental health providers in the region, Northwest Medicare out of Thief River Falls and Northwestern Mental Health Center out of Crookston, and they both sit at the table with us as we discuss this program, these programs. We're also also looking for a consumer to be a part of our committee also. That to date, a consumer has not sat at our board, but we are looking for that person. Our budget is approximately $1.2 million. Most of the budget dollars has come from the Alliance buyout of state employees that occurred just about a year ago. And that the DH budget, now again, these are my totals that I remember and not documented totals, but that the DH budget for our region prior to the Fergus Falls Regional Treatment Center closure was about $12 million. And a lot of those dollars were spent on that facility and its upkeep, but sometimes the translation, the savings to the state, and the buildup of community services, we're doing it on $1.2 million. Our challenges that we've been most frustrated with is making the feds and DHS's realize that evidence-based practices, I said services there, to make them cash flow again in our region because of its size, because of its population density, that it's difficult for us to cash flow those evidence-based practices. And we'd like to look at more practice-based evidence. If we are meeting the outcomes and things that the state has set up for us, could you not look at our practice and not necessarily make us implement new programming, but to say that the programming that we are implementing is working to meet those outcomes? So those are some of the discussions that we're having. And then, of course, continually challenging is to provide all those services regionally. And even in my region, Kitson County is an outlier, and for me to be at a table to advocate for the residents of Kitson County, I think is imperative even in our region, is to make sure because of where the service providers are located, we're on the outer regions of both of those providers. They're both, one is 75 miles away from us, one is 65 miles away from us, and to make sure that I can advocate that the Kitson County gets its fair share of services is important to me. And approximately, I just picked one program, CSP, just to give you an idea, is we approximately have about 500 CSP clients in our Mental Health Alliance. But that just gives you a snapshot of in what we gain then, and I think what the state gains is reporting. Is now the reporting to the state, the agreements that go back and forth to the state don't come to one entity and not all eight of us. And that is a great relief to county directors who don't have one more agreement to have to go through, and I'm sure from the state's point of view, seven less agreements that they have to look at and manage. So that was one of the initiatives I wanted to share. The next one is, and I apologize again.
Ms. Johnson?
Yes.
Just a question on the, you know, equal access, particularly in your county where it is pretty sparse, and you said you have to always be an advocate to get those resources beyond those kind of centers that are 65 to 75 miles away. Have you found some successful models that you think really work? I mean, do they, you know, put someone a half day out in your area that rather than requiring people to drive 75 miles to an appointment one way? Or, you know, are there some models that you've been able to work out in trying to make that happen?
We are working right now through the initiative, and we've been able to get telemedicine so that we are now all telemedicine compliant and ready. So we have it in our clinic and in also in the Northwestern Mental Health Center. So we are moving ahead with telemedicine. And hopefully, although I'm always an advocate for face-to-face, especially for our our elderly or even our my age population who isn't so used to talking to a television screen or a computer screen, that I still would like the face-to-face, which we're working on.
Senator Berglund.
Yes, Madam Chair and Ms. Johnson. I know that in New Mexico they went to a statewide telemedicine system for serving clients who need mental health treatment. But when they did that, they did it in a way that the client is never alone. They had an advocate, not necessarily a licensed professional mental health provider, but a trained advocate that would be with them so that they were not alone and they could receive assistance in terms of interacting with the provider that was on the other end of the telemedicine conference. And I'm just wondering, do you do that or are you planning to do that as a part of your effort?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator, it's just literally launching, but that certainly sounds like something that would be something that we should consider. I guess mainly what we were considering is such as our CSP workers that are out in the community with a lot of our mentally ill, that they would probably sit in with them to make sure that things are going and that the questions that need to be asked and by the client and vice versa are being asked. But I can see where an advocate would be of great importance too. So that's something that we could certainly consider as we move forward.
Well, Madam Chair and Ms. Johnson, I would encourage that. And I don't know, I guess one of the reasons is because, you know, if you're doing a therapy session and a client is getting into things that are tender personally, you wouldn't want them sitting in that room all by themselves, you know, having to deal with those issues without having a real person there with them, so that they feel like they have that support. And I don't know how well telemedicine works or if there's been a discussion of it for chemical dependency. And, of course, we know some people with mental illness issues also have chemical dependency issues. Have you been discussing the use of telemedicine for that area?
Quite frankly, no, we haven't. But we do have two, I believe, CD providers in our region. And that's something we definitely could, but no, at this point, I guess we haven't looked at it. We did have for a while the one of the CD providers was sitting on our mental health board, but due to other things that a change of directors that isn't continuing. But that's something we could certainly look into too.
Thank you.
If you turn the page, then again, this is me not being technically savvy, but just to give you an idea of Kitson County is dependent on regional services. To all the dark and dim circles on the next page are regional services. Now, some of those services do come up to Kitson County, but some of those are we do have to travel out of county to receive. But that, you know, Kitson County is very aware to provide the array of services we need for our clientele. We need to be regionally connected. It's something that we cannot do by ourselves. The next initiative I'd like to talk about is our Kitson County, is our region Council of Collaboratives. And I'm not sure if anybody, if you, either of the members are aware of the collaboratives, which is the Family Services Children's Mental Health Collaboratives that were formed as a way to draw down federal Medicaid dollars for school-based services. And in our region, there were six counties that were that did form collaboratives. But then even as collaboratives and single entities, we to go after bigger federal funding, we knew that we had to band together. So we formed a regional council of collaboratives, and the primary goal is just to promote the welfare of youth and families in the six county areas by coordinating human and financial resources to maximize the efficiency of services offered by its members. Now, in this initiative, Roseau and Pennington County is not involved, so that's why our region drops down to about 60,000 people instead of the 92 if those two counties are in with us. But that is why we've formed. And then the rest of the pages here is just a PowerPoint presentation that kind of highlights some of the things. Again, it has the mission statement. And then not only are the counties involved, but there's 52 member agencies that are in the Council of Collaboratives. And that can includes every school district, CAP agency, special education district. They are all members of our initiative. And we sit at the table together as we look at families and children and services they need. And again, a majority of the reason why is to look at grant opportunities. And we the collaborative Council of Collaboratives reviewed approximately 600 grant opportunities, 21 of those which we considered as a governing board, and two that were identified to be written. We also looked at, again, the subcommittee to address technology and telemental health services in our region. And then also a school-based mental health services grant, which we did receive from the state, to help make sure that school-based mental health continues to be strong in our area, as we realize that that's an effective place for services when you're talking about families and children. We also have a chemical health task group that looked at plans to develop an interagency group of staff throughout the region and intervention and prevention plans as a region. We are award winner of the Association of Minnesota Counties in 2006 and also a 2006 award recipient from the Hubert H. Humphrey Institute for Public Affairs. The next kind of we do this pretty much through the website. We do have websites that are available for anyone in our region but also for our members. We have on the right are some of the initiatives we've had. We had a Safe Schools grant, and out of that Safe Schools grant, we also wrote an emergency response grant, which means that every school in our region has an up-to-date emergency response plan, and also did have a site view if they needed a lockdown with law enforcement. Everyone had a run-through with law enforcement that was coordinated through that grant. Prairie Winds was a after-school physical education program that is just ending up but was a good success in my county. And then I mentioned last time is our Children Succeed initiative, which is, again, looking at redefining how we deliver children's mental health through family-based initiatives and wraparound. And those are all site-based. What we're finding is on our Council of Collaboratives site, we get an average of 1,000 unique users each week. And our website has been used nationally as an example for rural areas of how to keep connected on programs and resources, and for families who need to know where resources are in the region, that they can click on there and look at the resources that would fit their needs. But those are just two initiatives that are in our region that I think are going very well and help us. I know it's sometimes in last meeting I felt like maybe I was a little too defensive. I always feel like sometimes I have to defend where I live, even in Minnesota, that we do a lot, but that doesn't mean that we can't get better at what we do, but that we do a lot of collaboration, because we know in our part of the state we can't survive on our own. We need to work together to provide the services for our residents. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? If not, we'll move down to the next example, which John Evert is going to provide about what's happening with Clay County.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there are many collaboratives that Clay County is involved in. I want to share primarily one I think is very exciting, and then mention a number of others that we are also connected with, which many other counties do likewise. The one that's, I think, unique for our region is called Northern Connections Incorporated, and it's a call center partnership with, initially it was the nine counties of our West Central region. Since that, we've added three more counties, so there's now 12 counties involved in it. It was modeled after a program in North Carolina called Connect Inc., which we visited on several occasions to learn how they work. Locally, it was initiated by West Central Initiative, the McKnight Regional Foundation in our region, as a part of their Family Economic Success Program. We organized it locally. It's about 3 years old now. It's an outgoing call center where we contact those people who have recently left MFIP, other social service programs in the state, to reduce recidivism, and we provide resources via telephone conversations. They connect with people that in our call center who are assigned to different counties, so they study and know very well the resources available in those particular counties, and they contact everyone that. We get the list from DHS and those going off of the system, and we make contacts with them. We think it's working well. We've been able to provide them with assistance for information as to where to contact, where to get help with child care, to help them with job applications, with many different kinds of things, banking needs, whatever it is that would help them to become self-sufficient in their community so they don't go back on the system again. It's been an exciting process. I think the one disappointment is that we have a hard time. We don't reach everybody. Only about half of the names that we get are reachable. Either they've moved or their telephones have been changed or something, so we have a hard time reaching all of them. But of those that we do reach, approximately 50% that we're able to reach, over 90% of them choose to be a part of the program. And some remain on the system for a short time and some an extended time. We will keep on in touch with them as long as they wish to be in touch with us and try to answer their questions. In most cases, the calls are outgoing from our office. They certainly can call in if they have particular needs, but we keep in touch with them on a regular basis to find out how they're doing and monitor their progress and so on. And it's not been long enough to have numbers as far as success in the system, but we feel that it's an improvement. We're trying to monitor through the local counties just to figure out the number that they feel are going back on the system. But at this point, the people we're working with are doing quite well, so we're happy about that. The counties involved are Clay, Becker, Ottertail, Wilkin, Traverse, Grant, Pope, Douglas, Grant, Manoman, Wadena, and Todd. And we're happy about the progress so far. Other collaboratives that we're involved with, and we, you know, these the counties change depending on the particular need and particular resources available. We have a three-county mental health crisis project with Clay Ottertail and Wilkin that develops crisis response to children's mental health needs. We have an adult mental health collaborative working with four counties, Becker, Clay, Ottertail, and Wilkin, which deals with shared assessment criteria, housing, flex dollars, those things that help us serve the adult mental health population. Clay and Ottertail County are working together in signs of safety and responding to families in crisis. We visited Carver County for ideas on how to do that project better. So we do check with other counties and learn from each other as to what we can do to serve our population and the needs that they have. There's a nine counties of West Central Minnesota are involved with a program dealing with family group decision making and collaborative grant writing and reporting. We meet as a region, divide funds that we get through our grants, and we share facilities and resources. We have the healthcare outreach program in our area. We've chosen to contract with Lakes and Prairies Community Action, and they're working in the Clay and Wilkin County area to help us reach out to help with Minnesota healthcare programs, both information and application. And that's just starting, but we are optimistic that that's going to work well for us. So those are just some examples of ways we collaborate in our area.
Mr. Everett, you know, there's been some discussion and issues have been raised about the concept of regionalization, and it sounds like you have a different region for almost every service, even though you're doing it with partners. And I assume that's based on geography, partners, where the providers are, as well as, you know, how big a region can. I mean, it might be that nine can do something efficiently, but some things you can only do it with two. It would be interesting to hear you comment on the concept of, you know, set regions versus the kind of flexible regions that you have by program.
Madam Chair, I think that we really need flexibility because there's different needs for different programs. No two counties are exactly alike. In some cases, they have particular needs that another county can assist them with. In other cases, they can do it on their own. So there's the flexibility really, I think, has been to the benefit of the counties and the outcomes that we're looking for. There's some advantages in structuring around a definite list of counties, but I think, as Kathy pointed out too, that different programs change. There's different needs that counties have, and I think there's a greater strength in being flexible to work together with those counties that can benefit from each other.
Senator Berlin.
Madam Chair, just a comment on this issue, though. It does sound like most of these collaborations have started out a little bit smaller, and then after they've gotten going, some other counties have joined in.
I think that's true.
So it may be that there's more leadership in some counties, and then kind of after you've shown how you can do it, then others are willing
Chair
to follow.
And, Senator, I think that's very, very true, that people, not everybody sees the benefits immediately. And by showing and proving that it works, others choose to join in later on.
Thank you very much for sharing that. And John Berg is going to share what's happening in Mattawan.
County, DHS, or Human Service, and Health. And when I wrote up my comments, after I had it all written, I all of a sudden realized I was mentioning a lot of health things, and this is supposed to be Human Services. So I apologize for that.
No, both.
And, but the examples are pretty much similar to that. Multi-county collaboration does not necessarily mean that several counties merge their county agency. It's a special county may have its own organization, but contract or set up joint powers agreements for selected services.
Whatcom County has several types of arrangements and alliances to to achieve specialized services to our county citizens. The County Family Planning Program is one. Whatcom County, together with Brown County and Nicollet County, established a joint powers agreement to provide this service in the three counties. Nicollet County provides the fiscal service, Brown County administrative services, and Whatcom County does staffing, with each county providing local staff for delivery of the service. The clinics and pharmacies in each county provide professional services and medications and supplies. This became more than a multi-county endeavor with the professional private sector involved. Another successful collaboration is the environmental health area, also known as the food, beverage, and lodging inspections. Whatcom County contracts with Brown-Nicollet Environmental Health for this service. They provide the complete service and collect the fees from the establishment. Whatcom County cannot afford to hire professional staff for this specialized service. Whatcom County also partners with Faribault-Martin County Health and Human Service for mental health services. Professional staff in the mental health field is in short supply in our area. And if I can just mention with that, that's quite often these staff are short-term. They'll come for a year, sometimes for less than a year. And so this partnership changes because the hours that are they willing to work in the counties also changes. And it's a very difficult partnership to keep going, not with the counties, but with the professional staff that we hire. We also collaborate with groups within the county. The three schools and the county have an agreement to provide service with each other that benefit all the entities. This work involves students in the county schools. The partnership is enabling the schools and county to learn to trust each other, and they may lead to more collaborative actions in the future. And I'd like to hear kind of say that we have many other things that we collaborate with other counties, one being our Minnesota Valley Action Council, which is a CAP agency of nine, and there are nine counties in that. We do the heating assistance. We do a Head Start and all of those type of programs. It's a very good collaboration. We work together very well. It's a nine-county setup. And then we also have a drug court, a multi-county drug court involving Brown and Nicollet counties, and we provide some services together. And I just hope we can keep the drug court going. It's very positive. And the three counties with two judges seems to work very well. An area in the Whatcom County that may come up for discussion in the future is in the child protection area. A supervisor on our staff has mentioned that she may be retiring soon. This is a special area, and I want the staff person to be a qualified and experienced in this field. And the questions I ask, can we find this type of staff? Do we partner with another county for supervisor in this position? With which county do we partner? What form of partnership do we use? As we consider this, we need the flexibility to choose whether to hire own staff or to use some form of partnership that meets the needs of our county. And there I would like to emphasize, what county are we going to be, would we be partnering with? Sometimes certain areas work very well with different counties, and I'd like to have the flexibility to go with a county that we work with the best in that area. My examples are intended to show that multi-county collaboration can be achieved by collaborating in selected programs using different partners as needs and staff expertise arise. Flexibility of the partners and the availability of specialization of staff are the drivers to establish a good working partnership. This changes as staff and program change and mature. Whatcom County is a single county delivery of both public health and human service and is efficient and cost-effective method to deliver these services to the citizens of Whatcom County. We partner with other counties and entities for special selected programs. Some counties have a multi-county setup, but they split the public health and human service areas. and end up with two separate multi-county agencies in different buildings in each county. This may be less efficient than providing all public health and human service under one roof, one director, and in one building. All staff personnel can network with each other and provide better services for county citizens, and that's what I want. I want our county citizens to get the services that they need and desire. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Berglund.
In the partnerships where you have a multi-service contract, for example, in the mental health area, does that mean that the staff would spend some days in your county and some days in the other county, or?
Yes, that's what's happening. And those days are becoming hours per month that they will spend in each county because these staff are so hard to find. I'm talking about the professional staff. A lot of the services are delivered by our social service workers, but the special staff that oversee these people are very difficult to find, and we just contract with as many hours as we can, and I say it's hours, not days.
So the barrier is?
It's staff.
The availability of staff.
That's right.
And that is continuing to be a problem even in a multi-county arrangement.
Yes, yes. I don't know how to emphasize, and I don't know how to really conquer that problem other than I suppose we just have to keep doing things. We've tried the salary thing, and it doesn't seem to make any difference. No matter what the salary is, if they get tired of living in a rural area, they come back to the metro area.
Well, I Madam Chair, I think it is an area that we need to focus on because I think it is part of what the legislative auditor identified in when he said that there were not equal services around the state. And so focusing on how to solve that problem has got to be part of what we look at long term.
And it's a challenge that both of us, I think, carry. That's right.
Madam Chair.
Representative Saylor.
And I would just like to add also that another situation that I've seen developing with many of our collaboratives between counties is simply, going to what they had said about staff, but now, with gas prices being so much higher, that is one other issue that staff that has to drive so many miles if they're going to do FaceTime with a meeting or provide a service to someone. That's not always, either it's reimbursed or it becomes a problem for the county unit because the reimbursement cost for gasoline has gone up so high. So I think when we look at some of these things, that's another piece that at least in these far-flung rural counties and perhaps the woman from Kitson County would concur. But that's another issue that perhaps wasn't before us earlier when we started this last year. But I think it is right now. And I would like to know if some of the other folks from rural counties have been noticing the same situation.
Thank you. Ms. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Saylor, that's most definitely true for us far-flung counties is the windshield time to put professionals on the road, and the loss of time and the cost for that is an issue, and hence why we are looking at telemedicine.
I see a lot of nodding heads here, Representative Saylor. Thank you. Next, we're going to go to sort of following up on sort of the broad range of issues that were and topics that were brought up as possible areas to look at new ways of delivering services. And I know the work group that met to over conference call to look at this, I think I was impressed with how many things have already begun to address some of these things. And the first item that we have listed is to discuss family child care licensing and adoption assistance. And we have Kathy and Kelly from our work group to bring us up to date on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will start with this, and Kathy will finish in the rough work so it looks decent when we're all said and done, hopefully. The committee, just to report to everyone, the committee, subcommittee consisting of Senator Berglund, Representative Loeffler, Lynn Singelman from DHS, Kathy and myself, along with DHS, or MAXA and AMC staff, had a conference call. And I'm going to refer to this document here. It has across the top Human Service Administrative Simplification Subgroup, some bullets along the side. You know, I think, as was just discussed, so often we talk about, you know, one of the solutions to simplification is, well, let's just regionalize, or let's just have the state do it, or have the regions do it. And that's fine, and we should have that conversation, but that's a 30,000-foot conversation. And at some point, we need to start landing the plane on the tarmac and figuring out, well, what does that mean? We throw things out there like, well, the state should just do child support. Well, there's a lot of moving parts. Child support, just to make that statement, might be fine, but what does it look like? Thus was the case around child care and also adoption. At MAXA, we have been working quite diligently on the very same effort. And what we were able to do, thanks to Patricia and Kate from AMC and MAXA, is put a framework together for this conversation. And what we thought would be helpful to operationalize the conceptual framework of any of these initiatives would be to take a look at, with some guiding principles around functions, and look at functions that are best delivered locally, and they may include, and you can see on there, we're concluding that if it needs to stay local, that means that the function requires face-to-face contact. It requires organizational and community resources on the ground, functions that require extensive work in their home environment, and functions that are funded primarily through local tax dollars. Those are all interrelated and independent of each other, but they're variables that we'd say if a service or a program fits some of those categories, it would be difficult to centralize and create a statewide, if you would, operate it out of a central location. Or if we do, you're going to lose some of those areas. The other category in the middle there was that which would be a multi-county or somehow centralized. Could be functions that could be administered from one or few locations. Functions that require a high level of specialization. I think a classic example would be that long-term care type specialized position. Function or situation of cases that occur infrequently. Once again, long-term care for some counties that might not have a real high number of long-term care cases, but when they hit, they're chaotic to try to figure out at best. Functions that require high level of consistency across the state. CMS is reminding us of this. Functions that serve clients across multiple counties or across the state, and also functions that are highly prescribed by state and or federal law. And so then we looked at, here are potential options, and this was just, throw all what we could think of as options. You have a county-operated, you have a multi-county or regional with joint powers board or other arrangements. You could do it statewide, state perform the function, or statewide contracted to a private entity. I would also argue that you could do a statewide with the state contracting with regional county, regional hubs within the county. We have a pilot going right now, and this is to the example, John and Senator Berglund, your question, is that, you know, there is a culture in this state which are some counties lead out, or groups of counties, and over time those best practices show to be just that, and other counties see the benefit, and other groups of counties, and it's the beauty, what I see, of a localized government structure that we have, is so many great initiatives do happen in that way, to the point where even the department picks up on some of that. You look, a lot of our child welfare services, family group decision making, and some others came out of counties and groups of counties that initiated that. We actually in Region 10 right now have a 10 of us counties are contributing to a one FTE of a contract manager that sits in Olmsted County's contract division. And the concept there is these contracts, in particular the Medicaid ones, have become quite sophisticated, and the tracking of them, the managing of them, have brought forth consistency, but you also have consistency in rate negotiation. So one vendor in one corner isn't charging the other county something else. So that's just one example, and where the state is being having to address CMS around that, it's something that could be considered. You then have the last, and finally, you have the multi-county regional approach, which would be contract to one or more private entities. So that was a framework. And then if you turn the page, this is an effort to operationalize, for example, one specific program, and that's in the family child care and licensing. My comment is I thought Senator Berglund's insight on the phone conversation was profound in that we get ourselves so caught up on the service, on the function and the service side. We're so like child care, child support. And what she suggested, which I think is very prudent here, is why don't we first look at the principles and considering how they're best aligned. So you have the columns that start from left to right with high touch, community organized. And you work your way over to right next to the funded with local dollars. You have the next column, specialized, expert required, or, and then all the columns to the right. If we actually looked at the service, and if we started doing check marks in those boxes, whichever of, depending on the compilation of those check marks, would drive us back to what service should be centralized or state-driven or stay at a county level. I think so often, maybe in our own defensiveness to what the system is, we start the other way around. And so what we have suggested, what we do here, for example, with child care, and I'm not going to go through this in detail and say where the check marks because I couldn't tell you, is we're going to actually highlight those last six columns. And what we're going to do is give, for example, the child care, and we're going to make sure, number one, we have all the appropriate functions broken out on the far right column. We're going to then give this to the child care committee within MAXA, of which also has DHS staff, has private 2C2Rs, child care resource and referrals, other private vendors, and MAXA representatives with very specific questions about, number one, could they complete this grid? Number two, would, you know, given the look of the grid, given financial forecast, would you have any ideas or concepts about moving child care into a regional approach, statewide? And so very specific questions that our intent is to come back once this is completed, and we would work that through back to this committee about what feedback they have for us. Clearly looking then, depending on how the boxes are checked, should drive further dialogue about what way, in which direction we go with that.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Mr. Harder, do you have any idea when you expect that work would be completed?
Sure. Well, I'm going to look over at my colleagues over there. Our intent would be that we, if you know, we can get this, we can get the document, the grid, with the specific questions to the child care committee with the hope and intent that they can get that answered in the next meeting, within the next 30 days. And they might create a subgroup, knowing how things happen here. They would create a subgroup of that committee that could get that back to us. And if we wanted an initial draft, but hopefully in December, I'm looking at Kate, or early December. Kate can help fill in these details.
Madam Chair, Welcome Kate Lerner, Director of MAXA. Our Early Childhood Care and Education Committee is scheduled to meet. I don't have the exact date in front of me, but it's early to mid-November. And I would assume that giving them some notice ahead of time that they could plan at that meeting to address this table and at least have a draft prepared for the next meeting of this task force should that happen, you know, mid to late November, early December.
Thank you. And is the same true for adoption assistance, that there's a group yes. that's going to fill out a grid like this?
Correct. And so I'll just move to say we've done the same. We've chosen two areas. The other one is the adoption services. And just as an – and so we're going to push that in through our Children's Services Committee. And we have some expert folks within that, and the department also is frequently – we're visited with the department. So we'll get the right people to sit at the table to have this. Kathy, I wanted her to share. She brought the adoption process checklist. And you can see, so, you know, our goal is just getting these kids to a point where they can be adopted. And then the real ticker tape parade happens when you find a family who's willing to adopt them. And then you hit this bureaucratic roadblock. And if you look, here is the checklists that the worker has to go through. 18 pages of checklists. And majority of them are, you know, federal man by rule, Minnesota and federal rule of compliance, and I do tend to call it kind of bureaucratic compliance with work, and I'm not pointing fingers, I'm just saying that's the system we're working in right now. And so and I do believe for the department's defenses, and they haven't had enough resources to staff that department, I think is as at the level that they've wanted to. And a lot of this paperwork, not only is it a lot, but then when they get to it, if there's something wrong, then it comes back to the worker to complete. And so you have this log jam of time that goes on while kids sit waiting for finalization. And this is my own bias statement, not endorsed by any organization. But if there's one thing that is worth investing in, when you have, having done child protection and child mental health, working with these families and kids and adoptions, if there's any place worth spending money as a state and a tax dollar, it's finalizing these adoptions and supporting these adoptions. It's a win-win on every angle. So nonetheless, that's an example we're going to give to the committee to come back with and say, could something like this be centralized in a function where we think the worker needs to stay in touch in the case open because they have the relationship and they're supporting that pre-adoptive family? But could the function, back office functions, work more streamlined than what they currently do? So that's an example of how we think this and other initiatives this grid could help guide the work of this committee, and we'll use the expertise of other subgroups to help us through that.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Mr. Harder, is the adoption process on a 30-day track also in terms of completing
yes.
the work?
Yeah.
Okay.
We will put a high priority on these committees and subgroups, and there are good folks at the department and in our counties that I think can get that work done.
Thank you. I don't think I've ever seen an 18-page checklist. Wow. The next items we have teed up for updates on where we're at is the child support reform efforts, and Chuck Johnson's going to help us understand where that's at.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have more paper for us. Studies, one of which is underway and one of which is in the beginning phases, looking at the child support system. These have been driven by a number of different things. We had the legislative auditor did a study on the child care system, I believe, 3 years ago now, which pointed out a number of issues within the child support system. But one of it was the complexity of the multiple players that are involved in the system. The state, the counties, the courts, county attorneys, judges, magistrates, and other departments and sources we pull data from matching and so forth. So that was one piece. Another piece is when the Deficit Reduction Act passed in 2005, that was a significant hit to money that goes to counties to support the child support program. So counties are now operating at a significantly reduced level in terms of federal support for that program. One of the auditor's findings was that Minnesota performs quite well on three of the four main measures that we look at in measuring our effectiveness in the child support system. The one we don't perform well on is an efficiency measure. That is the dollars that we spend per dollar collected. We're 37th in the nation on that measure. And so one of the things we want to look for, given that we have less money, is there a way to be more efficient and still be effective in delivering services? And other states have managed to be effective in those measures as well as being effective in the cost efficiency measure. So it does seem like it's possible. And we initiated two studies to help us figure this out. The first one is called a policy business process redesign analysis. This was driven, this is a little more of an inside baseball, looking at some of the technical aspects of how the program is run. This was driven in part by a realization that we have an aging computer system supporting this program as well, the PRISM system, and looking at the financial subsystem of that system that is now doing things that it was never designed to do in terms of collecting fees, which I never anticipated. We now do collect fees. We also now have a formula that looks at the income of both spouses. That's something that this system was not designed to do. So we've been jerry-rigging and making it work, but the issue is this the right thing to be doing for the longer run? This study is really looking at all the policies and procedures within the program. And Deloitte is doing this study for us. They started several months ago. It will be finished in March of 2009. We had multiple meetings, endless meetings, with county staff as well as staff within our own department at and in the court system as well, and what goes into the process of delivering child support services to individuals, establishing orders, enforcing orders, and so forth. We have, in talking with other states, identified that we have taken interpretations of federal law that are probably more complex than we need to. One of the things we want to look at is there a way to simplify the way that we've interpreted federal law, which will help simplify some of what both workers have to do and what the system has to do. And this study, as I mentioned, is going to be finished in March of 2009. The second study, which is on the opposite side of the page, I think you should have one, is called Service Delivery Study. This one focuses more on some of the who does what kind of functions, and what does the state do, what do the courts do, what do the counties do, how could some of that be relooked at, are there different ways to rearrange those functions that might be more efficient and still just as effective. This study is looking at not only different models for service delivery, but we also want from them an implementation plan of how they would actually get us from where we are now toward what that more efficient model might be. This will again involve meetings with counties and folks that are currently delivering services, also looking at other states and how they deliver services, making comparisons between Minnesota and other places, both other county-delivered states and other states that deliver services centrally, and comparing those. And this study is, the RFP was released, I believe it was in September. Proposals are coming in at the end of this month. We hope to have the contractor on board by the beginning of the calendar year with the completion date of the fall of next year, fall of 2009. And this, as I said, this will be the one that will look more at sort of the who does what and are there ways that we can streamline and more efficiently deliver services in terms of the structure of the program itself.
Just a comment. I have, when I've gone to conferences and other places, I've heard that concern that sometimes Minnesota does interpret things pretty narrowly raised, and I hope that we'll look at that in other areas as well, because it seems like so often when questions come up about particular programs or could we simplify, it's like, well, no, the feds require this, and you know, maybe we need to, maybe the federal government is a little more flexible than sometimes their language might lead us to believe sometimes. And we ought to explore that when we can. So I appreciate that being part of this project. Thank you so much for your work on that. And it's a big project and much needed. Next we have, Chuck is also going to talk to us a little bit more about the long-term care eligibility termination. We heard a bit about that earlier today. Is there
I'm
more
sure
to add?
I don't think that I'm talking anymore about it. I think what Troy provided to us earlier is what we have to provide on that.
Great. That'll give us some extra time, and I suspected that might be the case. And Lynn is going to summarize some other efforts that are going on between DHS and the counties right now. Thank you.
Yes, I'd just like to quickly walk us through the document that's titled Summary of Existing Human Services Reform Activities that Relate to OLA Report Recommendations. If you recall, the legislative auditor noted or highlighted several items that had potential to be looked at for reform, and many of those we've been discussing today, and many of those items do already have work underway with DHS and the counties. And I won't spend much time on things we've already heard about, but I'll just walk us through the list that the OLA highlighted. The first one is adoption services, and in light of some recently signed federal legislation, we do have some work underway. And Chuck, would you mind just giving a quick update on that?
Sure. This is Fostering Connections and Adoptions Act that Congress just passed and the President signed, which actually will have quite an impact on our adoption assistance, relative custody assistance roles in hopefully a positive way. It does open up more reimbursement through the federal 4E mechanism for guardianship, which is our relative custody program, which right now we get no federal reimbursement on. And also over time, a long time, about 9 years, it'll open up more 4E federal money to flow in for adoptions when children are adopted who have special needs, which is most all the kids that get adopted out of foster care. So that will also help expand the 4E eligibility, which is currently limited, extremely limited by an income eligibility test. But there's a lot of complexity in that that we're still working through to figure out exactly what this is going to look like, what it's going to mean we have to do in terms of adjusting what our current program structures look like and so forth. So we're still in the process of analyzing that.
Thank you. Child care licensing was another area noted by the OLA that's been previously referenced here today, and as there are no formal efforts yet underway in that category. Child support enforcement, Chuck Johnson has previously talked about the efforts underway there. Child care assistance was another area noted with no formal efforts in that area. Waiver contract management. MAXA has recently begun a work group with DHS to clarify the roles between counties and the state in administering home and community-based services. And this group will hold its first meeting at the end of October. We've also...
Chair.
Senator Bergman.
And is there a timeline for this committee on waiver contract management?
Is there a timeline, Kate?
Again, Madam Chair, Kate Lerner with MAXA. This group is just getting underway. Actually, our first meeting is scheduled to happen this week, late this week. The original intent of this group has morphed somewhat to include some concerns that the department is wanting to address that relate to some concerns that they have, that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has with the way in which our waiver services are currently administered through the counties. And so because of the timeline that is accompanying that, we're hoping that this will be on a fast track and at least have three meetings of that work group between now and the end of November with a draft report or at least some ideas generated by that time. I'll have a better timeline or a more concrete timeline for you after the first meeting of that group this week, because that's the time when we will sort of address exactly what outcomes we're looking to have from that work group.
Thank you.
Okay, and then the next two items we have already heard about through the Healthcare Connect update. And then if you flip the page, there were also some recommendations in chemical health. And as you are probably aware, there's been a redesign of Rule 25 that was implemented July 1st of this year. And that is the CD assessment process and decision criteria for individuals seeking publicly funded chemical dependency treatment. Right now, we are scheduling face-to-face meetings with placing authorities and providers. Those will take place in a series of regional forums. The CD division will conduct an evaluation of Rule 25 placing authorities in early 2009. And in July of 2009, we intend to have a web-based tracking system established that would monitor compliance with the assessment and referral requirement timelines.
Singleman, I seem to have heard a concern from someone, and I can't even place it in my memory banks right now, about that there were some changes in chemical dependency that were supposed to be effective July 1st of this year, and yet... there wasn't kind of lead time or the guidance or something hadn't come out. Maybe that's, and I'm sorry, I can't remember more details, but were any of the changes effective this year or it's all targeted towards July of next year?
My understanding that it was to have taken place this year, but I can certainly maybe double check that. Yep.
Thank you. It might have been someone who was confused and anticipating it and didn't realize it was for a year later. I'm not sure. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Senator Berglund, do you want to add any further comments about our conference call meeting and sort of the themes of that?
Well, one of the areas that we did talk about a little bit was chemical dependency, because that was one of the things that was especially noted in the legislative auditor's report as an area where we're providing pretty uneven services around the state. And most of those services are being provided with MA dollars, so this is a concern. And we know that the formula for the block grant is a problem that may be contributing to this. And while we've taken stabs on the legislative side, at least, in proposing to try to fix it and phase in a fix over a number of years, we have not been successful in getting that to happen. And we talked about the fact that it may not be very likely to happen this year either. And yet we thought that in terms of some of the gaps in services, in terms of the availability of service, geographic availability, that this might be an area perhaps that the department could take a look at, and maybe we could begin to look at ways to use our federal block grant to perhaps address some of those gaps, and that maybe that could be done without having to go into all of the rest of the financing that needs to be discussed in regard to the county match. We also talked about definition of services, again, based on, you know, geographic distances. And does it make sense for, you know, someone to be recommended to receive outpatient treatment, for example, if that means they have to travel 75 miles each way per day or per week or whatever it is to get that service? Would it be more efficient to recommend in that case perhaps some inpatient treatment? Those were just questions that we raised during the phone conversation. We identified this area as an area that needs sort of ongoing focus beyond just this fall leading up to this legislative session, but we did think that at least identifying geographic gaps in services and beginning to look at those a little bit more closely in terms of how we use our block grant dollars might be a way to start addressing that concern. Another area that there is not really much going on in terms of the report that we received is child care licensing. And but it has always seemed to me a bit of a strange phenomenon that the department licenses child care centers and the counties license child care homes. And I've heard all the arguments about why the counties license child care homes, but I haven't heard very many arguments about why the state then licenses child care centers. And so it does seem to me that while this might not be the most pressing need in terms of simplification, that it is something to keep in mind, especially if in the future we're talking about the state taking over some responsibilities that the counties have today, because it makes more sense for it to be done more on a centralized basis. And those were the areas that we haven't really addressed very much in terms of the other reports. I don't know, Representative Loeffler, other areas that come to mind in terms of the conversation that you might remember.
Well, one that I had put on the table, I talked about briefly, was just, and it's sort of related to the long-term care situation, but it's actually sort of beyond that because it's not just eligibility, it's the follow-up, and that's the MA recapture at time of death. And that's a very complicated area, and it's an area where I do believe there is some real inconsistency in the discretion of county attorneys and who they go after and who they don't and how. And I must say that just yesterday I met a family where a brother had recently passed away, and they were pretty upset because when they were settling his estate, they found that they had to pay almost $20,000 for CD treatment that he had gotten 27 years previous. And it was interesting to me because I just the context has always been seniors and nursing homes and, you know, sort of that close to end of life thing. And they were wondering whether or not their brother had ever in those intervening years been contacted about this. He had turned his life around, had been very successful. He probably would have taken on a time payment plan. and done some things to deal with that, but they wondered whether he even knew about it. And I had to say, well, gee, this is a new one for me as well. But we had teed that up as a area where it's incredibly complicated, and there may be some equity issues across the state in terms of how that recapture is working out. I think the other discussion that we had that was just, you know, given the economy, caseloads are going up, people are exploring much more whether or not they're eligible for public services, whether they're eligible for publicly funded health care, and we know our budget is not going to be easy this coming biennium. It's going to be hopefully not as bad as some of us see in some nightmares. But the reality is counties are right now strained. We heard at the beginning of the meeting with meeting current standards with current personnel, and I'm hoping that as we look at all these reports coming back, that some of the work groups will focus on issues that can be quick and easily implemented, just as Senator Berglund kind of talked about. Maybe you can't deal with the whole big elephant on CD financing or whatever, but are there things that we can do that we can quickly implement that will help improve efficiency, that won't require a year's worth of computer service or that sort of thing, to help make sure that people in tough times who are seeking services that they're eligible for can get those more effectively with our current workforce. For those of you who are on the conference call, other issues you think we should bring up? Senator Berglund.
Well, Madam Chair, I just want to mention this. Everyone on the phone call seemed to think that this MA recapture was sort of ripe for possible reform. There was discussion about local conflicts of interest in regard to this issue where, you know, the county is trying to recapture dollars, and there may be also a city lien against the property, and so that there's oftentimes a lot of local pressure about the order in which claims should be made. And of course, if we had this being done as a more centralized function, that would be less of a concern. And so the question that I have, I am leading up to a question here, is the MA recapture something that this long-term care eligibility work group is looking at? Or is this something that we should be, this work group should be taking on more as an issue for our future meeting? Does anybody know?
Mr. Mangan is going to give us some insight.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, it's not something that we've included within the scope of what we're looking at this point. We've been focusing on the certification and the centralization, but I think as we start to move forward on that, if that becomes an issue that people think we can put in some process changes to help with, outside the policy changes, and that's something we're certainly open to look at. The more I find about long-term care, the more rocks you turn over, the more things crawl out from under them. So certainly these kinds of things will probably come up as we start to discuss with the counties about this.
Mr. Mangan, would there be a centralized person in DHS who actually is sort of the go-to person on this recapture who could actually even give us sort of a simple listing of all the places where we do recapture? Like I say, I was surprised to hear that we do it in CD treatment and so I'm just, you know, even just starting with the basic understanding might be helpful to me at least. I don't know with the other legislators, but it's an area where we haven't focused as much time and attention as others.
I assume that there is, but I can't tell you for sure. I know actually from my time in chemical dependency that in terms of our collecting client fees and all, there were staff that were working on that. But in terms of the scope of that and in what different areas, I don't know, but that's certainly information that we can find out.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Singleman.
I think that would be Jan Taylor. She's in healthcare.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
Well, one of the reasons that we seem to, those of us on the phone call at least, seem to think that this was a particularly good example of something to take on is, A, because it is very time-consuming at the local level, and cases in some counties come up fairly infrequently, And it's also one of those things that's not, doesn't really require face-to-face contact. And there are a pretty stringent set of federal rules about what you have to do. And so it just seemed like this would be one area where maybe we could spend some time focusing a little bit and make some quick progress in terms of coming to a resolution of how to. Doesn't seem like it's very politically sensitive in terms of, you know, somebody's got their stake in the ground over, you know, they've got to do this at the local level necessarily. So it seems like it might be a good one for us to focus on in the future.
Well, thank you very much. And last time we spent some time talking about vehicles as assets, and there's been some work done since that time by DHS and Senate staff and others to look at that area. And I understand, Chuck, you're going to start the discussion.
Madam Chair, thank you. You have a chart in front of you that lays out the current policies across cash, food, and medical programs around vehicles as an asset and how they're counted. And this shows the program. It shows what value is used, which is either trade-in or loan value. Those are both values that the worker would get out of the NADA book, the little blue book that has values in it. Trade-in value is generally a little bit higher than loan value, so that if you look, you can see we use different values in different places. The authority in Minnesota law or federal rules that's driving this, and then the summary column involves something about sort of what actually the policy looks like and what's counted or not counted in the different programs. And then the final column to the far right shows whether or not this is automated, and this is looking at automation within the current MAXA system. There is some alignment if you look at sort of starting in sort of the bottom of the middle page going to the second page around programs that might be more for people with disabilities or elderly, like GA, GRH, MSA, the parts of MA that deal with. They're not exact, but they have similar concepts involved. One uses loan versus trade-in. That's the main difference. There's not as much alignment if you look at EMFIP and food stamps and then MA for families and children in Minnesota care. There's some differences there. Mostly this is in our control, as a state, not obviously this committee on its own, but the legislature could realign these policies. It begs a couple of questions that have come up already today, one that Senator Berglund raised earlier about, you know, where's the value added in all of this, and I think the second one is automation. Where this is automated on MAXAs, it's relatively straightforward to do. Where it's not, it's quite a bit of work for the workers to have to do the fiat panel and fill in the values and do all the calculations on their own.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner Johnson, are there areas where doing alignment would raise the price tag of the program for the state?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, it depends on what direction you do the alignment, but there is value attached to these policies. Certainly, I know within the cash and food programs. I'm not sure about the healthcare programs, but I'm not sure why it would be different. That is, that if you do, you know, make it more generous, it will cost you something because you will make additional people eligible who are currently being found not eligible based on the vehicle as an asset, and vice versa. If you were to tighten it up, you may get some savings. If you did multiple things across programs, then you'd have to look across programs, and you may have some uppers and some downers, and you might balance out closer. But I know we did, the MFIT vehicle was changed last or the year before, I'm not sure, 7 or 8, and there was a small cost that was part of increasing the value of the vehicle in the MFIT program.
Mr. Johnson, not being familiar with these, is there a big difference between a loan value and a trade value? I mean, it would be nice to just have one value. I mean, is it generally a 1% difference, or is it a fairly wide range? I've never looked at these things.
Madam Chair, my understanding is it depends on the car, so it can vary some as to how big the difference is. But it can be pretty big, I think, particularly with an older car, where you may still have some trade-in value left but very little loan value. I don't know if others in the room know more about it that could weigh in. I looked through the book a little bit, and that was what my staff understood. So,
Mr. Harder.
Madam Chair, Chuck, thanks, number one, for you and your staff. This is good work that I think really shows to the, and I'm going to speak from the county's perspective, the frustration in that there's some, what you pointed out, natural alignments, and the assumption there is that, not your assumption, but there could be an assumption in larger counties, you have workers that just work those service areas, but in other rural counties, we have workers who are doing all these programs. And so even though there might be some natural alignments, it doesn't matter because whatever they're coming in to apply for, they need to know these requirements. And also, I want to point out that there's times of which it goes beyond the vehicle, but if they have a boat and they have motorcraft, they have motorcycles, it all starts to get factored into this mess. And thus, I would strongly encourage, you know, I think this is a good example of something this committee could make a recommendation to work further through. How do we bring consistency to this? Let's use either loan value or trade-in value. Let's either exclude a vehicle or not exclude it and just find a way within the state's control and bring as much uniformity and then get to the automation piece. Because at the local level, these are the little things. When the cases are getting pressured like they are and there's no end in sight to that, this is the little stuff that ends up taking the majority of time when they're fighting with the consumer about the value of the of a jet ski that was donated to them. It's back in the garage. It takes, and then they call us and argue about us and want to file appeals to the state and want the commissioner's number. It's true. And thus, I think this sheds light on that. And I would also love to see a grid like this on reauthorization or reverifications to Senator Berglund's earlier comment, what drives some of that in our health care eligibility as well.
Madam Chair, I'd add to Kelly's point, too. There's each program has a list of excluded vehicles that aren't on here anyway, where for most part every program in some way or another with somewhat different language it will exclude a vehicle you're using to produce income. So if you're self-employed in some way, food stamps has one, I think it was food stamps, where if you use the vehicle to deliver wood that you heat your house with, they get down into the weeds when you get into these things.
Well, to the members of the work group, what would be your suggestion for who should get down into the weeds and actually step forward to sort of sort through some of these complexities? Because it does feel like this is one area where we could actually improve the efficiency and the fairness, quite honestly, of the system if there was more consistency across programs. But it might be a good example of how do you take a sticky wicket. And I know Max has got so many work groups right now. I don't know if they can handle another one. But you know, is this something that internally within the department there could be some discussion to ramp it up or any? Mr. Harder has a.
You know, it's simple here. When I'm not the one who would be on it, but I will have to say, in appreciation for what truly are the assets in this state, are so many of great county staff, and we have some real experts that sit in, you know, throughout the state. And I would bet to say that, you know, this is what it is. I mean, there's statute, there's numbers. It's pretty factually based. There's a lot of variables, but I would bet to think if we brought some of our kind of top horsepower into a meeting room, if DHS was willing to put a few people, have them go at this and, you know, and start putting a few more columns that get to some of those nuances of heating fuel and other thing, driving a truck or four-wheelers, and see if one meeting, what does that bring forth? You know, don't commit them to eternal meetings, but have one meeting, roll up their sleeves, and see if they couldn't come out with some recommendations with the goal and oversight that of consistency, et cetera, et cetera. I think we could get it done. I think it's worth doing.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, it seems like, I know, for example, the eligibility for people that are sent the domestic violence brochure program, there was no cost to making it totally an exempt vehicle. It was done for political reasons.
I'm sure that's because it's food stamp program. It's all federal money.
Right. So I just make a little asterisk there that is not based on a financial decision. Could be changed without a financial impact. The area where it does have a financial impact, I think, is the family investment program. But I think it would be worth finding out how much is the impact. I mean, it might not be that it's that much of an impact. It might you know, I would hate to see us bringing all these other programs down to the level of the MFIP program, because obviously we would be moving in a direction then of having fewer people covered under our health care programs. And the vehicle of the value of the vehicle of your car doesn't buy you health insurance. You know, it's what you have to get to work usually. And it's what you have when you lost your job and when you lost your insurance and da 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 da. So so maybe it's worth looking at that one area and, you know, getting a fiscal note from George about what it would cost to change that area. And then maybe just asking to have a fiscal note done both ways, if we make everything based on trade-in or if we make everything based on loan value, and just see what we get. Because I think that kind of information would be needed to inform any group that's going to meet on it.
The other area that I would say in terms of the MA aged, where they're excluded a vehicle regardless of value, I know it's a common practice to use that as a way to shelter assets by buying a vehicle, sometimes for a senior who doesn't even have a driver's license. And so we might want to look at whether or not it's a used vehicle or they're at least capable of using it, because that has, I know, been an issue with some families and some of the advice that they're getting from the legal community. Is it possible in our current automated system to find out what percent of people are denied eligibility based on a value of a vehicle? I don't know what the system's capability is of kicking out data, but it might be interesting to see if this is even, you know, this is a, you know, for most of these things, it may be that it's not the key determinant, it's more the income.
Madam Chair, it is possible. That's how we've done the fiscal loans.
Yeah.
It's not a large number, but it is a number.
Yeah.
Above zero.
Thank you. Great. Any other comments on the vehicle issue? Didn't realize we got to the point of jet skis. Any kind of vehicle.
Madam Chair, we get to the point of used combines in the tree rows and how much value they still have. So it goes beyond jet skis in Kitson County.
And there is a book value for used combines.
No, there isn't. It takes a lot of time to figure that out. So.
Called scrap metal.
Yeah.
The more we discuss things, the more complicated they get.
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
Just in terms of for planning purposes, it sounds like if we have our next meeting in early December, that a lot of the work that will be accomplished before the session would be done by these various working groups, and that might be the best time for us to look at having another meeting in terms of productivity of this group. Does that sound okay if we work with you all on your schedules and try and find a date in early December?
It would probably be a Tuesday through Thursday. In that we've heard from Representative Abler that he has clinic on Monday and Friday, and so it's difficult for him to get away then. But
Madam Chair, if I may, since
Ms. Johnson.
Since for me it's driving to Chicago, okay. I would like to, we do have our MAXA scheduled meeting down here for December 3rd and 4th, so if December 2nd would work, that would be extra great for me. If not, I certainly will make whatever time is, but that would be helpful.
Excuse me, Connie, within Tuesday. Yeah.
And how about, and then December 5th would also be Truth and Taxation, is that? or is that
Truth and Taxation is Thursday night, the 4th, so okay. The 5th would work fine for me.
We'll take a look at that and see if we can make
Thank
that
you.
Work.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, the following week, Association of Minnesota Counties has their meeting and annual meeting in Duluth, so we would be occupied with that on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. So, but the 5th, the week before, would work.
That's helpful. Thank you. With that, if there aren't any other announcements, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you so much for coming. Oh, Representative Saylor.
Kind of waiting for this endpoint.
Senator Berglund?
Well, I believe that most of the money is federal and has federal eligibility criteria attached to it. I believe that if there are any state funds that supplement it, those could be designed in a way to fill whatever gaps we think there are in the federal eligibility rules. But I don't think there's a lot of state money in this right now. It tends to be the kind of thing that is done from time to time with one-time money. And I know one time we did use TANF funds, and that also has eligibility, federal eligibility connected with it, but it was being used to extend the federal LIHEAP funds more than they otherwise would be able to be extended. So I'm kind of thinking that it might be a future issue, but I don't think it's an issue right now for this group to look at.
Madam Chair, well, I think that's true, that much of that, but what I was wondering about is, some of the other programs, such as the veterans program, again, that's one of the federal, but they, with the extra funding to the veterans service officers,
just looking around the table to see if there's anyone who feels like they're ready to leap in, but it appears like it's one we need to get some more information on. Representative Saylor, Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Saylor, my staff have been meeting with the folks from the Department of Commerce who run the low-income energy program because we do coordinate between, and the counties know this, the emergency assistance dollars that the counties administer and then what's done through the low-income energy heating program. So just to coordinate that we're on the same page in terms of communications to people about where to access help, what to do if they can't get help one place and how to go to the other place, and that the two counties and CAPS are talking to each other as, you know, everybody's concerned that the federal heating money may not be enough to get us through the winter. But there is, you know, a dollar question that goes with that, too, that the money that we have is the money that we have. But that's more just about trying to coordinate how we're doing our work across those two programs.
I would say, I think, in terms of, you know, converting to, you know, alternative energy or any of those other programs that might be available to people, that would be outside of the purview of the knowledge and work that the people around this table are involved in. It might be a different committee of the legislature might want to have some oversight hearings on it. But I don't think it's within the expertise of the people that are involved in this working group.
Madam Chair, thank you for that clarification. I just was not sure exactly who was going to be working on that particular part, other than the Department of Commerce, which I've been in contact with. But I just wanted the clarification. Thank you.
Commissioner Everett?
Madam Chair and Representative Saylor, I think that, I mean, I really agree with you that this is a crucial issue for the state. Counties are very concerned about it, have been talking about it in a number of meetings. Community action agencies are working with counties to try to deal with the crisis that's coming. Alternative fuels is being used by people, but there's great concern about the safety of that, since there's some people that are going to be burning wood in chimneys that haven't been inspected and used for 30 years. A number of concerns both with fire and with carbon monoxide. But I don't believe this committee is the one that should be dealing with it. So it's something that I think your community action agencies are working on it right now, and county commissions are all talking about it. So,
thank you. Senator Sharon.
This sort of segues into something that I was going to hold for another meeting, but I think I'll just mention it now. I did not attend the last meeting that was held of this, but I did attend the meeting that was held in 2007 when the group was first organizing itself. And in reaction to the report, and I'm hearing I really support the notion that we need to, in terms of our time and effort, try to identify some things that we can do very rapidly to get some relief. Particularly if we aren't going to be able to give economic relief, there may be other public policy relief we can give to counties, and I think that has to be our greatest gift in terms of what we can offer as a group. But I just want to add that besides the two, what I think are the two focus areas that may have come to some agreement from the group last time about centralizing for greater efficiency and effectiveness, based, as we're saying, on what unit, what organizational structure is appropriate for the task, and ways of streamlining eligibility for these particular healthcare programs. Another really important issue that was raised in 2007 when we first met had to do with maybe a longer-term problem, which is a cultural change around how we establish public policy and creating a process or a system so that counties or other units of government that are impacted by the policy have an earlier entree into the policy development, so they're not left to a reactive position after we're putting something in front of the legislature. So I'd like to add that somewhere as an objective that we might be trying to achieve that has, I think, a long-term benefit that we get a vision ahead of time and we can avoid some of these complexities that are costing everybody so much time and money.
Senator Sharon, we did talk about that briefly in the last meeting, and the counties have been working on a more sophisticated sort of quick response fiscal note process to more quickly be able to respond to what the impacts are of some of the things that we might be proposing. But I think you're right. It's more about a culture change than it is just about getting data. It's about how we approach our work and how much we build in flexibility and how we trust our partners to do responsible work and maybe focus more on outcomes rather than on process. Commissioner Schulmeyer.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I think we are working on, you know, areas that we can improve upon that have been established. But I think a key point that this committee should be working towards is how do we go about improving process so that we don't end up in this position again on anything that gets implemented from here on in. And I think you would find the county is very receptive and actually very excited to try and help develop a process, maybe even something similar to what we have with the Department of Health in our State Community Services Advisory Committee. The SHAC process is one that we find works very well. It allows us on a regular basis to work with the department along with elected officials are always at the table and, as well as staff. And so we help do background research on many initiatives and bring those forward. And it's been very successful, as I said, and something similar to that or mirrors that would be very exciting and something that we've talked about at the Association of Minnesota Counties as being a process that would be something that our efforts in collaborating with Department of Human Services could benefit a great deal.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any further comments? Thank you so much to our presenters. I think we've all learned a lot. And to those of you who are going to be in all those interim meetings before our next meeting, thank you for stepping up and to your members who will